Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Well, do you need some help controlling garden pests? We've got some tips for you today. Our guest is Kevin Schesso. He is the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn County. He coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for that Tri-County area. So we'll talk with Kevin about integrated pest management, talk about keeping down weeds, and of course we'll take your other gardening questions as well as we move along today. We can also talk about fruit-bearing plants, for example. Love to have you part of the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Kevin Schesso, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, good morning, Larry.
Well, we're going to be talking a little about integrated pest management, and that includes a number of methods, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a concept, just like a lot of things we do in our backyards. We got to think about what we're doing and what our pros and cons and the pluses and minuses of all of our gardening activities. And integrated pest management is just a concept that we use to manage, you know, pests and make healthy plants and healthy soil. And so, yeah, it's sometimes we don't think about it, but we're probably doing it every time we go out and look at our plants.
Yeah, probably, because there's, I don't know, there's pruning, there's mulching, maybe staking or trellising.
Yeah, yeah, those are all what we would call our decision-making, you know, tools that are in our toolbox. We often refer to, you know, making decisions in this kind of period or pyramid of how do we approach a pest problem. And the basics of integrated pest management really start with, you know, understanding the plant, the community, the environment, life cycles. So it's that knowledge. And that's what the Ideas Network is all about, right? We're trying to get people informed so that they can make a good decision. So that knowledge is key. And then from there, you look at what your decision-making tools are. And, you know, that would include biological controls or cultural controls, mechanical controls. And then finally, kind of as a last resort, we use this, you know, term for chemical control. But these are all just options we need to consider, and sometimes we need to use them all.
What can you start doing right now that will help with pests?
Well, again, you know, I'm assuming most people who are into gardening, you know, have some life experiences or previous knowledge that they've gained, however, you know, whether it's formal or informal. So, you know, we all have a different, you know, we're at a different place in our ability to take in new information. But if you just walk through your gardens and walk in your backyards and observe, so that's that first step is you got to be aware of what's going on. And this is the time of year where most of our gardens have been planted. Granted, we're a little late this year. But, you know, now that we've gone through all that hard work of getting our plants in the ground or pruned back or, you know, managed or whatnot, now is when we need to really be watching for signs and symptoms and just looking at how plants are responding to, you know, the weather or, you know, other environmental things that might be happening in that little microclimate that they're occupying. So you just need to, you know, look at your plants and talk to them, right, and see how they're doing, you know. And that's the first step, because if we're totally unaware, how do we know that there's even a problem? So yep. if you can see there's a plant that's not looking quite so healthy, then that's your first clue that, oh, I better start paying attention. And sometimes we can, you know, nip it in the bud, you know, pun intended, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that's where it starts, is just doing your scouting and observing. And then from there, we have to do, and I've mentioned this before, I believe, on the show, is horticulture CSI. Yeah. Crime scene investigation, right? You know, put on our thinking caps, and we've got the crime scene. Now let's go collect evidence. And that's where IPM, the principles of IPM, really start to fall into place, because now we have this kind of systematic approach to thinking observing and then looking at our options and not jumping to conclusions. You know, the last thing I want to promote is – you know, spraying something on a plant just because you see an insect. And it's like, oh, I got to get rid of it. I got to kill it. You know, that's the last resort. There's other processes we need to think about first.
Carl in Hayward has a question for you that relates to this for sure. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Say, Kevin, about 5 years ago, you helped me get my apple orchard started in Hayward here, and it's doing great. And this year, there's a lot of blossoms on quite a few of the apples. I think I have 12 trees. But I want to be a little proactive here. I'm thinking about, I'd like to keep them, you know, organic as I can. But what should I mean, one of the things you're saying is be aware. What should I be taking a look at of any pests that might attack these apples? And I know, you know, one of the things that always comes up are wormy apples. What can I look for, and then how can I control it?
Sure, sure. Well, I think apples are probably one of our most popular backyard tree fruits, and everybody aspires to have that perfect, crisp, tasty apple. And if we're going to do that, you know, we do sometimes have to intervene and be aware. So you already mentioned one of the probably most common insect pests that I'm aware of and I often get questions on, and that's the apple fly maggot. And that insect lays its eggs on the developing fruit. So that hasn't happened yet, but, you know, we need to be aware that that's probably our most likely insect that can cause those railroad tracks. They're often referred to, the evidence that was left behind by the maggot that was in the apple while it was developing. So if we want to, you know, prevent that from happening, you know, we have to understand the life cycle of that pest and of that fly. So apple fly maggot is typically laid on developing fruit towards the end of June into July. And that's where those red balls, those sticky spheres that attract the females, and then they get stuck on it. So that's an organic method to preventing the females from laying eggs on the apples, because now they're stuck on that, you know, fly trap. So apple fly maggot is one that I typically encourage people to think about, especially if they've had it in the past, to use those sticky spheres. You can also use kaolin clay kind of as a coating on the apple, and the eggs maybe won't develop, or the flies aren't as interested as landing on those apples with the kaolin clay. From a disease perspective, I think most people who've grown apples have run into apple scab. That's a fungus. You know, culturally here, again, another management practice that's not necessarily spraying something would be pruning and training your apple trees so that they're more open, they get better airflow, there's not as much moisture on the leaves. So, again, that's that cultural practice. And if you do need to treat and protect the leaves, then we got to spray a protectant that covers the apple leaves, and that would be, you know, technically we're going to call it a fungicide. Now, a fungicide may sound like it's something like chemical and non-organic, but, you know, a fungicide is simply a product that protects the leaves from infection. So that could, again, be that kaolin clay, or it could be a more synthetic type of product that we would purchase, you know, at a local garden center. So those are the two things that I would be on the lookout for. The apple scab, you'll see little olive-colored lesions on the leaves, which then can transfer to the fruit, and then the apple fly maggot. Those are the two that I would be studying up on and making sure you're aware of when those infections happen. The fungus is happening right now. The apple fly maggot, we've got a couple weeks.
And those sticky apples that you stick up in the tree or that you put in the tree, do you put like one per tree or what do you do?
Yeah, you know, they're too, you know, maybe in this case, more is better.
Yeah, I would say.
You know, it's not always what we want to recommend. Oh, if, you know, a half a pound of fertilizer is good around my tree, maybe I'll put two. Well, no, that's not the way we want to look at that. But these are, one per mature tree is probably enough. But if you want to put in more, some people use these red-colored Dixie cups, again, for that color. I don't know if it matters a whole lot if they're round or not. Obviously, apples are more round So you probably would be better off using a round sphere that's red versus like a little Dixie cup or something. But yeah, lots of ways to do this. And then it's Tanglefoot, the smeary stuff you put on there.
And Carl, thank you so much for calling. Good luck with your apples this year. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking today with Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Kevin Chesso, Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Started out talking about controlling pests in your garden, kind of a never-ending task, but you may have some other questions as well. I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's take a call from James and Marinette. I guess we lost James. All right. Well, let's go to Nick, who was interested in planting an elm tree and wondering what's the status of that tree right now. Is it okay to plant an elm tree?
I guess there's a lot to that question. I guess, elms historically were very popular in the landscape. You know, the American elm was a big planting in our cities and street trees. And Dutch elm disease, of course, took care of a lot of those street trees. So, you know, we still have to be aware of Dutch elm disease. But I know there's still plenty of elm trees out there, and I don't see why you couldn't use that as a planting in your landscape. And I guess I'm trying to figure out what other information he would like on elm trees. Is there more?
There are some that are resistant, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. I mean, that's all part of this IPM process, is we can, you know, select varieties that are more resistant or tolerant of diseases. So because of the Dutch elm disease epidemic, 30, 40, 50 years ago now, there are varieties or hybrids, if you will, that are probably more resistant to that Dutch elm. So that would be something to look at when you're selecting an elm tree. And I don't actually know how many on the market are resistant to that, but I would think because of the past, we've got varieties that are much more tolerant of the disease than in the past.
And Joe in River Falls emailed, he's been having trouble controlling gooseberry sawfly on several gooseberry bushes. Last year in September, they completely defoliated the bushes over a weekend. This spring, he's been picking them off twice a day, but it's been tough to keep up with them. He's been dusting diatomaceous earth almost daily so it stays fresh and dry. That slows them a little bit, and he ordered some neem oil and hoping that will be effective. Any other advice on controlling sawfly damage on gooseberries?
Well, sawflies are one of those pests that are fairly host-specific, and there's any number of sawflies that will, attack or lay eggs on any number of different species. And this is where somebody like PJ Leash really comes in handy for getting some additional information on these host-specific kind of insects. But the hand picking will take you, so far, right?
And not going to hurt.
It's definitely not going to hurt. It's 100% organic, I guess, if you want to use it that term. But, I don't know as if you want to spray anything that's going to be toxic to our pollinators. And if you've only got a few bushes, sometimes just being tenacious in hand picking and getting rid of them that way, there might be some BT products that would work on that. but I, again, I'm not 100% sure. This is where if you go on to the internet and you search sawflies on gooseberries, UWEX, chances are you're going to be linked to a fact sheet that maybe PJ helped co-author that has more specifics on what your options are for controlling that with a spray. I'm not a big fan of spraying, but there are reasons to do it. And maybe, like I said, there's a BT product that would work on that. But I'm not 100% sure.
And if you had a few, maybe a floating row cover, would you think that would help?
Definitely. You know, that's another one of those control tactics is physical barriers. And a floating row cover prevents the adults from coming to the plant and laying the eggs. But if, you know, go online, look up the life cycle of a sawfly, and you'll know exactly when that risk of egg laying happens. So you just have to be ready to have your row covers on prior to those adults coming and laying their eggs. Hmm. And that's, again, a timing issue.
So. Andrew in St. Paul, Minnesota has a question, I believe. Hi, Andrew. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Looking to get some control options for some moles and or voles that seem to be destroying my lush, beautiful green grass. It seems like every time I seem to get a grass bottom, I find a new path that they're going through. Is there any sort of spray or granulated products that you can recommend that could really give the final blow to these little buggers?
So these are tracks in the lawn, sort of raised tunnels?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. And this is, again, where we have to know our pests and make sure we're talking about this, you know, the proper suspect in this case. So moles with an M are the ones with the paws and the little pointy nose, and they eat insects, right? And they're after worms and other soft-bodied insects. And that's where they burrow underneath the root zone, a couple inches, cause those inverted tunnels, and that's what we get to step on, and it's, you know, visually not pleasing. The voles with a V are, you know, like meadow mice, and they typically don't burrow underground. They stay above ground. So in this case, I'm pretty sure we're talking about the moles. And there are repellents that you can use you spray on the turf. There may be a castor oil-based product that is out there. As far as trying to eliminate the moles, now you've got to think about their, you know, habitat and where they're coming from and how many are there. There are baits and there are traps that are more lethal, and you can set those traps in the active runways, and they're just like a mouse trap. They, you know, they run into the trigger and they get exterminated, if you will, that way. And if you've only got one or two, you can sometimes eliminate the problem just by, you know, strategically placing one of these traps. If you've got a lot of moles, then you've got to wonder, is there other food sources there that they're going after? And sometimes people will go to putting an insecticide to try to kill the grubs that maybe the moles are going after. But now, you know, that's maybe going to have off-target impacts on other soil insects as well. So I tend to try or recommend that you go with the repellents in those castor oil-based sprays first, and then if you're okay with a trap, those can work. And then the last approach would be doing some kind of an insecticide to eliminate or reduce the food source, because that's what brings them into the lawn, is there must be something there that, you know, they're eating. That's what brings them into the area. So those would be my three options.
Yeah, those traps are vicious-looking things.
Well, sometimes, you know.
You know, yeah, sometimes you got to do it. And frankly, those tunnels, one mole or two moles can make it, you know, you look at your lawn, you think, oh, there must be 30 of them out here, and it could only be one or two. They make a lot of tracks.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, lawns are such a visual, you know, that's why we grow them, because they're nice and even and visually pleasing, and doesn't take much to disrupt that when you got these tunnels crossing this way and that way, and it doesn't look good. It's maybe injuring the turf at the same time. So, yeah, I understand.
So MoMed or something like that, Andrew, may be your first option just to get started and see what happens. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Francis in Muskego, it's your turn. Hi, Francis.
Hi. I got a little rabbit in the garden, and we've tried sprays, but you can't spray the sprays on the – we're eating kohlrabis and stuff, but you can't spray the stuff on the sprays. We tried live traps with all that stuff you smear on the leaves to encourage them with all different kinds of things, and we just don't know how to get them out of there. And we got it. It's a fenced in, a 6-foot fence, because we got deer and stuff. Is there anything else that I can try?
Is it on the bottom of the fence?
It's a 6-foot high fence, and the little rabbit lives right in the garden. He's always running around, and we just tried every kind of thing to catch him, and we can't catch him.
Oh, that's unfortunate, because you would think having a fence would be your defense to keep the critters from finding your vegetables. So, I mean, if you have like the chicken wire kind of fencing the top, you know, 2 feet around the garden, that should be a good enough barrier to keep them out. But if they're able, especially the young ones, you know, they can sometimes get through some pretty small openings in our fences. And so now how can you encourage that bunny to get out of there so you can maybe seal up those areas where he found it or she found their way in? So you think it's living in your garden, or is it coming and going?
He got in the garden before we planted the seeds. We know it's our fault, but he got in there and we didn't realize before we planted, because it's a 6-foot high fence and has always kept him out. It's burrowed in the ground and stuff, but somehow he got in there and we didn't realize it, and he's been living in there. And now when the stuff is coming up, he's having lunch.
Do you have a gate for that?
Sure. It's fenced in with a gate, and he got in. The gate must have been open before when we were doing seeding the garden and stuff, and he's been in there for a long time.
You might want to get a neighbor or two over there and open the gate and chase the darn thing around until it runs out of the gate.
Tried that.
You tried that?
There's one smart bunny. He knows where lunch is, and he doesn't want to leave. I don't know. I mean, Larry, what you suggested was where I was going to go, is, you know, somehow figure out a way to chase that bunny out of there. You know, a bunch of people should do it, or do you have a neighbor's dog that could, you know, sniff it out? And but
that'd be another good way—a neighbor dog.
I don't know if you haven't been able to catch it in a trap.
Well, he's got too much food to get enticed into a trap. But maybe a few more people and a neighbor's dog, and that gate open, can get it out. I think, Francis, that's the best we can do.
Yeah, I can't see trying to do
it. There's lethal means, but you probably don't want to do that. So I think that's the best we can do today. Let me know how that works out, will you? Thanks, Francis. Vicki in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi there. So here's the problem. It's creeping bellflower.
Ma'am, you're breaking. You're kind of breaking up. Can you maybe? I don't know.
Try it again.
There. Okay. There you go.
Creeping bellflower and black landscaping cloth, is that bad?
So you're using the black landscape fabric as a barrier, or what? Trying to keep it from invading, or
where it's really bad? I just stamp it down so it's low, and then spray it, and then put on landscaping cloth and then mulch, because it's, you know, coming right up next to peonies and other things. I want to dig it up.
Right, right. Okay, so here we've got an instance where we've got a very aggressive plant that's now a weed. It's in the wrong place, and it's got this extensive underground root system, and it's well-established and interfering with your peony. And how do you kind of get rid of it, right? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, physically digging and pulling can only get us so far with certain plants because of those underground root structures and the size. You know, if it's a very well-established patch, that could take a long time to do it physically. You can sometimes, you know, smother it out with, you know, the black plastic and get it hot enough. But now, how does that impact your peony that's right next door? An option might be, do you even think about, you know, moving the peony and then renovating that area and trying to rid it that way, versus do you use a selective herbicide that might be able to translocate down into the roots and take out that, you know, root system with, you know, with some kind of spray? And that's where people get a little bit nervous about taking that approach. So you just have to be that much more diligent in trying to suffocate it with, you know, the mulch and with the plastic and starve it out, if you will. But that may take several years, and, you know, that's just how nature is. Sometimes you gotta just slowly, you know, knock it back through other means rather than using a chemical.
The only, well, the one good thing about it is at least creeping bellflower is a pretty plant. The flowers are pretty.
Oh, yeah. Well, creeping Charlie's another one we often talk about in lawns, you know, and it maybe has some other benefits that we forget about, and if the pollinators like it or if it looks, you know, but in this case, that's maybe not what she's after.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, so, you know, smothering it, solarizing, digging, and at the last resort, you might have to think about very careful selective application of a herbicide. But again, you got to be careful you don't get that on your peony or other ornamental or plants you want that are close by. So,
yep, there you go. Good luck, Vicki. Thank you for calling. We have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Kate emailed that she'd like some information or maybe clarification about the best material to use to top dress a perennial bed. Common materials, of course, wood chips, you got mulch and compost, which she picks up at the public yard. She's been using mulch or wood chips. Will compost burn the plants? Which of the three materials, if you got mulch or wood chips or compost, which do you think is best?
And what was the plant?
She's got a perennial bed.
A perennial bed, okay. Yeah, anytime we can get an organic mulch to cover the soil and prevent weeds from germinating and hold in moisture and all the benefits of a mulch, you know, that's what we're trying to do in integrated pest management, is use that method to manage weeds and all the other benefits. So if it comes to picking one over the other, again, you just have to look at the, you know, the pros and cons of each. So the wood mulch is going to be high in carbon. It's going to last a lot longer. It might make a nice mat depending on if it's shredded bark versus little individual chips. So, you know, that material will definitely accomplish that weed barrier, but it also has the opportunity to, what we say, steal nitrogen from the soil as it's trying to break down. So those high-carbon mulches, we just need to keep that in mind, and as long as we're providing some supplemental nitrogen to our plants, or if our soil is rich enough and has excessive nitrogen to use for the decomposition, wood can be wood chips can be perfectly fine. The compost, she was saying, is it toxic or could it be
would it burn
harmful?
The plant? She
burn
was...
the plant. Yeah, you know, compost is another one of those. If it's store bought and you buy it from, you know, from a reputable retailer, I'm assuming, you know, it's gone through the proper composting procedures, and it's, you know, maybe it's been heat treated high enough or sterilized some way so that you're not bringing in anything that would burn the plants. It's usually the the ammonia and the nitrate and or the nitrogen in a compost that might cause the burning. That's why we don't use like poultry manure around plants because of that, you know, high ammonia. So compost, in my, you know, from what I know about compost, it should not have a really high ammonia or anything that should burn the plant. And then the last one, Larry, which was?
So you had wood chips, mulch, and compost were the three.
Wood chips, mulch. Yeah, mulch, again, now we're getting into terminology. A mulch, in my opinion, and maybe that's what the caller's thinking, is something that's more like shredded leaves or grass or something not as high in carbon. Mm-hmm. So a mulch there, too, you got to understand your source, where it's coming from. If it's high in carbon, you got the same concept with the wood chips. But most mulches are probably going to be all three of those are good choices, in my opinion.
Yeah, and if I'm using a mulch, sometimes I'll put a little fertilizer down before I put the mulch down.
Yeah, no, that's just to kind of guarantee that you're not going to run into that nitrogen deficiency with that decomposition over time. And all of these are going to enrich the soil over time. And
that's
you know me, Larry, I'm all about my add more, till less, so add more organic matter, and these organic mulches and composts are going to slowly, over time, be added to our soil and just make our soils that much better versus a non-organic mulch, you know, like black plastic, for instance. That really doesn't do much to benefit the soil. It gives us our weed barrier and maybe it maintains heat or whatever the goal is there, but there's no organic matter being added to the soil with those.
Let's take another call. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. James and Marinette, your turn. Hi, James.
Morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I had a question about Dawn Redwoods. I bought a bunch of them, and the tops were dead on them, and I cut them off. Will they reform a new top?
What was the plant again?
A Dawn Redwood tree.
Dawn Redwood.
Hmm.
I'm not, I mean, is it Redwood? Yeah, I don't know. I'm not real familiar with that common name. Is it meant to be a shrub?
Fall off, you know, and then looks like a dead tree in spring. They come back kind of furry.
Okay. So it's a bush tree or what's
it can be a regular tree, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Anytime we lose, the woody structures, the top parts of trees and shrubs, and we have to cut them out because they died or we need to prune them out, you're going to change the shape of that tree. And, as long as the tree is able to kind of have auxiliary buds that replace what died back, I guess you'd have to ask yourself, well, why did this tree die back? Is this something that was in the landscape for more than a year, or is this a brand new planting?
Well, I think the reason he died is because places like stores that sell stuff don't take care of them. So when you buy them, when they close them out,
this is a containerized plant that you brought home, and now it's in pretty tough shape.
Looks nice now, other than I had to take the top off because I'm just feeding half-dead top, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, in this case, you know, it's just corrective pruning then, and you'll just have to keep, managing that plant and seeing how it regrows. And, you know, if you're looking for a certain shape, you might have to do a little bit more corrective pruning. But sometimes plants, give them a chance. They're going to fill in, and you'll have a plant that's desirable for your landscape. Again, it's the look. You know, what kind of look is that going to have? And if it's an eyesore, maybe you don't. Maybe it's not going to work.
Well, those Dawn Redwoods, they'll get to be pretty big. They were they discovered in China, I think, not that long ago, maybe 60, 70 years ago. And they're a zone 4 to 8.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with this plant at all. I apologize. So that's where I'm kind of drawing a blank on trying to visualize how this, you know, tree wants to grow and you know, how you would manage that. Like I said, if it's a shrub, you can do renewal pruning. They come back. If it's more of a tree, you know, you start messing with that, the apical dominance and that main leader, right?
That's what I was thinking.
Everybody knows what happens on the power line. You know, power companies come through and they got to clear out the power line areas and they top trees. You know, that really changes the way that tree looks. It doesn't necessarily kill it, but you're not going to end up with that nice columnar or pyramid shape, you know, form anymore. And again, if that's what this tree wants to be, taking the top out is going to, you know, change how that plant might look.
Yeah. Almost for sure. It's almost like other trees, as you say, when you take the top off, it's not going to have that conical appearance that it you know, a normal one, quote unquote normal one, would have.
Yeah, and on a younger tree, you can maybe it'll correct itself. And
yeah.
Maybe as you know time goes on, you end up with a tree that is not half bad looking.
Yeah, I wouldn't give up on it, James.
Keep it happy. You know, keep it planted in a nice sunny location and follow all the recommendations for that species and keep it watered and you know, if it wants to live, it'll tell you.
Yeah. Does that help, James?
One other quick question. I bought a bunch of these variegated maple trees, but for some reason they always turn rusty looking or black, the leaves. And then the forester told me that they don't get enough nutrients to the ends of the leaves. That shouldn't have nothing to do with the rust spots all over them.
Well, the rough spots, are they black spots?
No, that's something else we got with a lot of our maples up here. But I bought these from, they're like hybrid variegated maples. They kind of got a white limey outer and then a little bit darker in the center. And they look great right now, but I guarantee within a month they're going to get rusty. Another guy's got one. His leaves actually turn black, like black. And I don't know if it's a soil content or if it just they shouldn't be filling these trees in the first place.
Well, you know, we don't want to make too many assumptions until we do a little bit more of that CSI I was talking about. So, you know, if we were to, you know, take a picture of that and you could send it perhaps to your local extension office and through Brian Huddleston's lab down at, you know, UW-Madison, he's our plant pathologist. My first assumption here is that, well, maybe we've got some kind of fungal infection going on.
Yeah.
And that's our first piece of trying to solve this is, you know, what is causing that change in color? And if it's a fungus, well, you know, that then leads us down a different path than if it's maybe more environmental, which would be perhaps, you know, the location, the climate, the soils, the lack of nutrients or the excess of nutrients, chlorosis. I mean, there's any number of things that cause leaves to change colors. But I would first determine if this is a disease or not. And, you know, a close inspection will help you determine if it looks more disease-like than nutrient deficiency, which we can sometimes get in our trees, too. And
Rare, though, for maples.
So, yeah. So my first assumption is that we've got a disease that likes to get in on those. And maybe they're... You're right. Maybe they aren't the best tree for your environment because of that. And that's why I'm always a fan of going with natives and going with plant materials that are from the area we're trying to, you know, grow plants in.
Yep. Yep.
And sometimes those real fancy ornamentals just aren't cut out for our local environments.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it. Chris in Appleton, we'll get to you in just a second. But a reminder, our guest today is Kevin Shesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Kevin Shesso, Extension Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Talking about all kinds of things in the garden. And certainly looking forward to your questions. Chris in Appleton has one for us, so let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I last fall had to have about a third of or a quarter of my backyard regraded due to drainage problems. And now I have my perennials put in there. But I did go to the city of Appleton and I got the free wood chip mulch stuff. And I have horsetail all over. Is that from that mulch from the city? And how do I get rid of it?
Guess it could be.
The consequences, and anytime we bring new materials into our landscape, there's always that potential of hitchhikers, and in this case, maybe that horse tail came in on the material you got from the city. So my first thing is to positively identify that it's horse weed, and then there's fact sheets that explain how to manage it. I don't know if Mark Renz, he's our weed scientist at UW-Madison. I know he's got a lot of information on different plant species, but that would be my first step again, is know your enemy. In this case, this weed that's showing up in your landscape now, and if you think it's horseweed, just verify that it is. And then you can pull, obviously hand pull what's there, but I don't know how many have you got? How big of an area is this?
It's probably 30 feet by 4 feet. I've pulled and pulled, but the roots are so long, I never get the whole thing.
Yeah. And that kind of gets back to that earlier question when you've got an underground root system that you can't get. If it's I'm drawing a blank on this, Larry, if this is an annual or a perennial, I'm assuming it's
a perennial.
It's a perennial. So now you've got that perennial root system to worry about. And hand pulling will only get you so far. And is this in your mulched beds? I mean, can you mulch over the top of it and try to smother it that way?
Oh, I could try that. Is there any weed killer or?
Sure. There's
adverse to
right. Nope. I appreciate that. At some point, that's that again. That IPM principle is like we go with these other cultural and mechanical and biological methods, and now we've got to say, well, is there a chemical option, i.e., a herbicide that you could spray to get into that perennial root system, and there are options to do that. And like I said, which one is best, I'd have to go online and look. I mean, of course, everybody knows about glyphosate. Trade name was Roundup, and, there's reasons to use it, and there's a lot of reasons maybe you don't. But that's a very common one for spot treatment, and it does translocate. It's systemic. It will go down into the root system. But there are other broadleaf herbicides that will do the same thing, but you got to be careful because it could get onto your broadleaf ornamentals, and that's where you just follow label directions and do according to what they say as far as application rate and timing, and maybe that's the best option to nip this in the bud and then get it all mulched, and hopefully it doesn't come back.
Yeah, there you go. And there are chemicals out there that will kill horsetail. So you can look into that, Chris, and good luck to you. Thank you for calling. We'll turn next to Cindy in Lake Mills. Cindy, hello to you.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. One is, my comment is that I had someone digging in my straw bale garden and in my iris plant, and I was ticked because I worked so hard on my straw bale garden. And I went and bought the hot sauce and sprayed it all around and even around my iris, just in the dirt, not on the iris itself. And nothing's been back in so far. So, and that's been almost 2-3 weeks now. So I'm happy with that. So it did work.
Good for you.
And, I was mad because I worked hard on doing my stuff. My question is dill okay with a tomato and strawberries? I got two dill plants, and one's by the strawberry and the tomato, and the other one is in with my cucumbers, and you know, they're measured out just like it said in the book. I mean, I did everything. This is my first time, so I did everything by the book. And I just, you know, it's not looking as healthy as it should, but it's looking okay.
So the dill's not looking healthy.
Correct.
Hmm.
I don't think there's anything in strawberries and tomatoes that would.
I wouldn't think so. Most plants, you know, as long as they have access to adequate sunlight, moisture, and nutrients, and there's not a lot of competition to keep them from doing their thing, I wouldn't think having those together should matter. Were the dill seeded or transplanted? Or
transplanted, and they were very healthy. Very okay. healthy.
Okay, and since how long ago did you transplant them?
I planted everything in May, the beginning of May, because I had did my bales in April, so the second week in May.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your watering has been adequate, and there's no, you know, because
1 gallon each bale every night, unless it's pouring rain, of course.
Right.
I'm entrusting in that book that I got. first time straw baling, and you know, my cucumbers are going up the vine. My husband put, you know, a nice grade around for me, you know, an mm-hmm. archway, and the whatever had gotten into my straw bale had also gotten into my little green beans, because I had put them in little starters and started them, and they're doing well, but had gotten into one of those too, and actually ate some of my green beans.
So the dill is in the straw bales.
Yes. But I don't understand why it's not as nice as everything else is in the straw bale.
Yeah, is it a paler, you know, it's not the color, what, when you say it's not as nice, it's not as tall and vigorous, or its color is looking off, or?
Its color is off. It's yellow.
Yeah. So it's not getting nutrients. You're probably, you may be washing the nutrients out.
Yeah, okay. And is it located more on the edge, or is it in the center of the bale? Or?
No, I put it on the edge.
Yeah, so perhaps, you know, through that because straw bale gardening is really like you're trying to get compost to happen in that bale. That's why you got to go through all those steps to inoculate it, and because straw in and of itself, you know, it has some nutrients but very little nitrogen. So that's why we're adding the compost, and you're adding some additional nitrogen to help, you know, compost those bales. And sometimes there's not enough of that nitrogen available to the plant, and maybe the dill being in the location it is isn't having the same access to nutrients as your other plants. Maybe the roots aren't as vigorous. Maybe that composting and the additives you put on that bale on that end aren't as working as well as they are at the other spots.
I'd put down some more nitrogen.
My guess is it's a fertility issue.
Yeah.
And it's just lacking in getting the enough nitrogen, like Larry said. And that's typically what we see when we see off color, the yellowing.
Yeah. So sprinkle a little more nitrogen in there, and maybe go to every other day or whatever. On the watering of that one for a time. Let's see how that works, Cindy.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. On my property here, I've got roughly 25 real nice tall balsams. I've got about 30 tamarack. I've got a terrible invasion of poison ivy. What would be the best herbicide to control this? I'm never going to do it by mowing. I mowed some of it yesterday, but I can't get in, you know, between all the trees. But it's getting worse every year.
Yeah, and this is a case in point because of the you can get rashes, and some people are really allergic to poison ivy, and this is one of those plants that we really have to be careful with. And there's very good reason to get it out of the landscape, especially if you're gonna risk coming in contact with it. And you know, so this is a case in point where you know, without suiting up with gloves and protecting yourself and doing mechanical removal, it's not very practical for most people to do that. So, again, you have the option of spraying it, and it sounds like you're willing to do that. And in this case, you'd probably have to go with a mixture of different herbicides, and there's any number of them that are labeled for brush control or poison ivy control. If you go to the local garden center, hardware store, you're going to see these, and triclopyr, dicamba, MCPP are the common ones that are in there. But it's usually a three-way mix, and those work very well on those woody, viney crops like poison ivy.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Lee. Appreciate your call. Well, Kevin Shesso, our guest today, he is the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Kevin Shesso, the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn County. So, having some problems with pests, maybe another garden question, what about your soil? Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Kevin, we have Julie in La Crosse who's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Hi, Julie. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about that black fabric landscape cover.
Sure.
We've had problems with blight and tomatoes over the last few years, so I put that down and I got my tomatoes cut in holes in the middle of it, and we've just got it stapled down. Is that going to overheat? Do I have to cover it, you think, or what's your opinion?
No, I think we're far enough along in the growing season that so you're worried about it being too warm? Is that what?
Yeah,
I guess the black is obviously going to attract the heat. Tomatoes do like heat, and I don't necessarily think that you'd have to worry about it getting too warm. Again, you just have to monitor. Obviously, you can take some kind of thermometer and check the soil temperature. But in general, tomatoes are very tolerant of warm soils, and I wouldn't necessarily worry about it. If you're a little concerned, you could always, sprinkle some straw on top of that to make that so it's not quite so absorbent of the sunlight, and it might cool it down enough to keep it from getting too hot for the roots, because it can. I mean, if we get really hot, warm weather, we have to worry about, plants overheating, and maybe the black plastic is going to be too warm in that case. But I think your approach is proper in managing the blight on tomatoes, because that's often spread from the soil, from splashing up on the lower leaves. So putting a mulch, and in this case a black fabric, should work just fine.
Yeah, shouldn't be a problem, Julie. Good luck. Thank you. Rich at Apple River, Illinois. Your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hello there. I just have a question. I've got two burning bush plants, and it seems like after this cold winter that we had, when they bloomed, I only have leaves on the bottom half of the bushes. The top halves are very sparse with leaves. Is that because of the extreme cold? They've been in the ground for like 6-7 years now.
Yeah, I am assuming, with our, polar vortex we had this year in the upper Midwest, winter burn, winter injury, desiccation from the effects of a long cold winter are showing up pretty common this year. And I think, Larry, you might have talked about that in a previous show.
Yep.
But anytime we have that die back, especially this time of year, you can probably assume it's from that winter burn. And, you know, burning bush, you can do renewal pruning on, and you can just remove any of the dead tissue, and it should, you know, sprout from the base. And okay. In this case, you just have to let nature run its course and see how the plant responds. Some of those branches may come back. Others of them may not. And that's when you just have to go in there and do some corrective pruning and take out the dead stuff and shape the plant. And it'll, over time, it'll come back.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you for your information.
You bet, Rich. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Jeff in Greendale, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I've got a really nice little gorgeous stand of Siberian iris in my yard, and I've always wanted to split it, but I'm afraid that I might lose the little I have, I might lose what I split. So my question is, when can you transplant those? Can you do it right after they bloom, or should you wait till the fall?
I'm always a fan of letting, doing things when the plants are more dormant. And obviously when they're in full bloom, you know, the plant is putting all of its energy into making those flowers, and it's a high stress period if you're going to do any kind of digging and dividing. So wait till the fall, and then, you know, you don't have to be too careful. Most of these, underground root structures and corms and bulbs, you know, you can go in and pull them apart and hack them up and dig and divide. And if you do that in the fall and move them to another location, you should be fine. So I tend to wait till fall to do some of those digging and dividing. Or you could do it, you know, in early spring as well.
Yep.
But dormant rather than during the growing season.
There you go, Jeff. Thank you. Joan in Madison, your turn.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to know some information on Epsom salts. I bought some tomato plants from a greenhouse, and they told me to sprinkle Epsom salts. And I've also heard that you sprinkle Epsom salts around roses. Can you give me some more information on that and what good it does, if it's you know anything about it?
Well, Epsom salt, it's one of those common amendments that, is often referenced to, you know, apply to the soil. And Epsom salt is just verifying this, it's a magnesium sulfate. All right. So it's a molecule of magnesium and sulfur. And, you know, our plants need both. And in this case, sulfur is something that's needed in a little bit more amount than the magnesium. So Epsom salts provide that added, you know, nutrient value to our plants. So, you know, that's kind of what it's doing. It's not going to, like, acidify or neutralize the soil in any way. It's basically just a plant nutrient that we are adding, to our soils as basically a soil fertilizer.
Yeah, I'd be a little careful with it. I remember somebody calling because they were using it to get rid of Creeping Charlie, I believe, and they wound up killing. They put too much on and killed their whole lawn.
Oh, of course. And it's just like most of our, and this would be like a chemical fertilizer, if you will, because it's just magnesium and sulfate. And it's technically a salt. That's the definition of those two molecules or elements when they're put together, just like sodium and chloride, or potassium and chloride. Those are salts, and if we put too much of it on our soil, we can increase the salinity, and, you know, too much is, in this case, not probably a good thing.
So there you go, Joan. Thank you so much for calling. Julie in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Yes, hello. I have a question. My son is making a raised bed garden. He is planning on not taking the sod up. He's going to put it right on his lawn, and he was going to put cardboard down and then put the soil and whatever over. But should he be taking the sod up? How do you do this?
Most people put in raised beds because they don't want to, either the native soil where they want a garden is poor or inadequate, or it's just not a good place to garden in. So you want to create this artificial, you know, soil, if you will, in a raised container. So the existing sod, why create more work than you need to?
Yeah.
And the concept of putting cardboard down is, again, the idea is you're smothering the sod. And depending on how deep is this raised bed going to be, you know, several feet or just a couple inches?
That I don't know, but I would say it's going to be at probably a foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're covering that existing sod with 1 foot of soil mix or, you know, topsoil that you're bringing in from someplace else, that should be deep enough or thick enough that the lawn underneath shouldn't find its way through. But better safe than sorry. Putting down that cardboard as a physical barrier is going to definitely smother out any of the existing sod that might want to grow up into the planting area. So that's not a bad thing to do. It'll decompose over time, and you know, hopefully the grass just adds to the fertility and the organic matter over time, because roots will find their way down into that eventually.
Sure.
You know, but raised bed gardening is a really great way to start gardening and doing it at a smaller scale, and then you can, you know, hopefully put in the right soil mix and soil combination so that you've got a good, you know, environment for those plants to grow in versus your native soil, which may not be, you know, very good.
There you go. Thank you so much, Julie. Appreciate it. Nancy called to say that many of her neighbors are having terrible time with leaf miners eating chard and spinach. What do you do to control without chemicals?
Leaf miner. So these are, I'm assuming, you're seeing evidence of some kind of larvae that's tunneling in between the upper and lower part of the leaf.
So it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. And there, too, once the damage is done, you know, you probably can't do much about it. Pick the leaves off and maybe exterminate those that are in there. Life cycle of leaf miners, something laid the eggs on there earlier. So at this point, you probably can't do much to change that. There's where floating row covers may have helped, but we're past that control option because the eggs have been laid and now the leaf miners are doing their thing. Doing a little bit of CSI work ahead of time and understanding what leaf miners do and their life cycle, maybe getting a treatment on, you know, earlier would have helped. And if there's a second generation, you know, that's when you have to be thinking about, all right, how do I prevent that second generation from impacting my leaves? And that's where those control options of maybe a floating row cover or, you know, some kind of spray on the leaves. But who wants to do that if you're going to eat it?
Yeah, right. You know,
so again, just learn more about the life cycle of leaf miners, and hopefully you can prevent it from happening again. But I think at this point, with the maggots in the leaves, you probably can't do much.
Robin in Marathon, it's your turn. Hi, Robin.
Big rhubarb plants, and this year some of the stalks are hollow. Why would it do that?
Marathon.
Do
you get a lot of water?
I was going to say, that's maybe excessive growth. I mean, if you're in a really rich soil, rhubarb, as everybody knows, can get massively large if it's in a good spot. And with all the moisture we had, maybe it's growing faster than other years, and as a result, you're getting some hollow spots in the stems. There's no evidence of an insect being in there. It's just like a open space in the actual stalk. Huh?
Yes.
Yeah. It's something environmental, would be my guess. And like Larry said, you know, with all the moisture we've had this year, maybe it just grew so quick that it didn't have that same integrity of, a solid stalk.
Yeah, that's my guess, too. Robin, thanks. Appreciate it. Heidi and Madison, your turn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am trying straw bale gardening for the first time, and mostly because my soil is causing my tomatoes just to be super blighty. And we followed the directions from one of the handouts I got online, and the temperature, we've been watering, we've been fertilizing, and the temperature got up as high as 97 in the bales. It's cooled down to about 88, and I'm not seeing any kind of decomposition that suggests it's time to start planting. The bales themselves are supposed to be straw, and they are just absolutely furry with like what looks like grass. And I just want to know, like, when should I continue to keep waiting to plant, or did I mess something up? So that's my question.
Well, I know, Larry, I think you have experience with straw bales, if I'm not mistaken. And this is that inoculation phase they always talk about, where you got to pre-treat the bales and get that decomposition and composting happening. So I'm assuming, you know, maybe the recipe to make that happen, 97 degrees. I don't know. Is that high enough, Larry, based on what your experience?
Should be high enough. And the fact that you're getting grass growing, you got some bales that weren't pure straw is what you got. But so those weed seeds are germinating. So the fact that you're getting weed seeds, and sometimes mushrooms, people say, oh, gosh, I got mushrooms. What am I going to do? Well, that's a good sign.
Yep. The biology is happening, and if you're sprouting weed seeds, you could probably grow a vegetable seed in there or a transplant. So maybe, just go ahead and start putting your plants in. And
I'd put them in.
Mm-hmm.
And, maybe watch them, and if they start lightening up a little bit, you may want to add a little extra nitrogen to the plants. I've done that once in a while. Sometimes people water too much when they're treating the bales, and so they're washing the nutrients right out of the bales as they're if they're applying too much water. So there's sort of a good there's a happy medium that you have to reach. But I'd go ahead and plant, Heidi. Go ahead. Lynn in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Lynn. Whoop, we lost Lynn. Well, let's see. Sandra emailed to ask where she can find those sticky apples, and what do they actually call them?
Sticky apple.
I think they just call them sticky apples. I'm not
sticky. What you do is you buy the Tanglefoot. That's the brand name. It's probably got other, but that's what most people reference when they say, how do you get the sticky part onto the apple sphere, is you apply this Tanglefoot, and it comes in a jar, and you goop it on there, and you can get as creative as you want in putting out whatever kind of red-colored sphere or cup, like I mentioned before. So Tanglefoot is the common name that I always hear referenced, and it's pretty sticky, so you got to be careful on
don't get
how
it
you
on
apply
your hands.
It. Mm-hmm.
Lynn in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, yes. I have a question in regards to carrot seed tape. This is the second year I've used it. I hate to thin out carrots, so that sounds like an ideal thing, but 2 years in a row now, they have not sprouted. I've not put too much soil over them. I know they don't need a lot, and they've been moist. But one of my questions is, I had a hard rain after I planted it, and I wondered, and I have a fairly heavy soil, not totally, but I wondered if the soil has made kind of a seal over it and they just can't break through, or if that's not the case with carrot seeds.
Well, carrots are pretty tiny seeds, and one of the challenges with carrots is they do take a little while to germinate. And if they're sitting around waiting to germinate and the temperature isn't right, you could get rot. So sometimes you'll lose the seed to rot. Or, like you said, if it's planted too deep, maybe they can't push through. I'm wondering if it's just the weather and soil conditions that are keeping you from being successful. And this is where you do that CSI. You got to dig up you know, where that tape was and just see what's going on. I mean, are the seeds, you know, there? Did they rot away? Did somebody come and eat them? Is the soil crusted over enough that they can't push through it? And just perhaps it's just not been the right germinating environment the last 2 years for this to work. Wetness, you can get too wet and they'll rot. So maybe that's what's going on here.
Yeah, I'd dig up one end of the piece of tape and take a look. I think, Kevin, that was great advice. Just do a little CSI there. Good luck, Lynn. Thank you so much. I wouldn't give up. Marcia emailed that she bought an organic weed killer. It's called Weed Slayer from Amazon. It's been working really well for her. She just wanted to pass that on to others. It's an organic weed killer, Weed Slayer. You know anything about Weed Slayer?
No, it's a creative name. And again, this is where we just have to use our intuition and, you know, read the label. What are the active ingredients? You know, how does this actually work? What's the mode of action? And, you know, a lot of times organic products are based off of natural products that are occurring, and they can be just as effective and also just as harmful if we're not applying them correctly. You know, we hear a lot about using vinegar as an organic weed control. It kind of burns the plant, you know, but it's an acid. Acetic acid is oftentimes what the active ingredient is. And so in this case, you know, just like all of our shopping, we just make sure we're understanding what we're buying and what the active ingredients are, how it works. And if everything seems logical to you, I'd go ahead and use it. So maybe this Weed Slayer has just the right active ingredients that are giving her the control she needs.
In the last 30, 40 seconds here, any programs or events you'd like to tell us about?
Well, I think I've, you know, as you indicated in the introduction, I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with our Master Gardener volunteer organization up here, North Country Master Gardeners, and we have our teaching and display garden at the Spooner Ag Research Station. It's open to the public, and there's events happening in that space throughout the summer. Our big annual event is August 13th. It's a Tuesday evening, and we are going to be honored with Brian Huddleston.
Ah.
PJ Leash are both going to be on site, as well as Brian Smith from UW River Falls, who was our kind of our fruit specialist. So we're going to have the trifecta of state specialists on hand for that event. So, and then we also have a Seed to Kitchen variety trial and research project. We're having an open house for that on July 23rd. And that's an organic vegetable variety trial with Dr. Julie Dawson out of UW-Madison.
There you go.
And that's for our market growers and anybody interested in organic produce.
Kevin, thanks so much. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much. Kevin is the Ag Development Educator for Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Our physical therapists join us on Monday.